Great. So thank you very much, Andreas. It's a pleasure to be here to close off this this exciting program. I got to be here for a couple of days earlier in the program, and at that time these results were not ready. So I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts today. This week is the first time that these results are being presented. So I'm going to talk about superconducting contacts to topological insulators, specifically 3D topological insulators with 2D surface states. And so I will give a very brief introduction to my view of this subject. The first few slides are just sort of jumping into the material, and then we'll step back and I'll give you a roadmap of where we're going. So over the last close to a decade, there have been interesting new 2D electron gases being studied to sort of complement the exciting work in gallium arsenide-based 2D electron gases over many years. And I'm going to focus on the so-called ones that have so-called Dirac fermions. I'm also working on 2D electron gases in complex oxide heterostructures, and that's another exciting area. But starting with graphene, where we have a hexagonal lattice, which is a triangular lattice with two atoms in each basis, two atom basis, you can think of this as being divided into two triangular lattices. So you can think of this hexagon being divided into one triangle here, one triangle there. And at special points in momentum space, electrons can live on one lattice or the other, and without tunneling between them, so there's a degeneracy. And then as you move away from that point, in those points in momentum space, then you get a linear splitting of the different superpositions of living on the two lattice sites. So that's represented here. Here's the special point in momentum space, and then you get an energy that goes linearly with momentum going away from there. I think that's familiar to all of you. And the system is described by the Dirac equation in 2D, where the speed of light is simply the speed of these electrons, and spin instead of real spin for the Dirac equation is a measure of which superposition of these lattices one's on. So the fact is that these systems are interesting not just because energy is linear with momentum rather than quadratic with momentum, but also because of the other parts of the structure of the Dirac equation, basically the relationship between spin and orbital motion. And so there are various tests, a lot of theory and various experimental tests that have been done of this sort of behavior. And for example, what happens when an electron in this system hits a potential step? To what extent does it get back reflected? To what extent does it get transmitted? And so a variety of that's been done in graphene. There are also signatures that's in bulk transport, especially quantum Hall effect, which has unusual fractions in graphene. So these systems are being explored, and I think that in graphene they'll continue to be increasingly exciting as we get to more ballistic transport. And there have been some important developments in that area. So now let me go to the topic of this workshop, another system that, so I think actually maybe I should sit on this side since most, stand on this side since most of you are on the other side. I guess I'll glance at Andreas once in a while. But so another system that has an unusual 2D electron gas is so-called topological insulators. And let me give you my naive view of this in part so that I can get your statements that I've gotten it wrong. But I think that I do not find it entirely satisfying to say that you can have two systems with different churn number, and therefore when you put them together, you must have a gap closing. So let me garble it a little bit. So I would say about a decade ago, people thought that they knew essentially everything there was to know about band insulators. Admittedly, you know, you have to actually do the K dot P calculation to find the detailed band structure, but essentially, a band insulator is a system that has a filled valence band, then a gap, and an empty conduction band, and that's about all there is to it. There are, of course, other very interesting insulators involving electron interactions, but I'm going to ignore that for today. So, so now we have the idea of a topological insulator, a system in which the states that would normally form the valence band are brought up to form the conduction band, and vice versa. And at first glance, this is really no different. This is exactly the same thing. We have a filled band, we have a gap, we have an empty band. And so it seems like it should be indistinguishable from an ordinary insulator. However, what happens if we put this next to an ordinary insulator? If we put it this topological insulator next to an ordinary insulator, then the states that form the conduction band in the ordinary insulator have the same symmetry as the states in the valence band in the new system, and vice versa. And these states end up connecting from one to the other. And so at any energy in between the two bands, so if you're in the bulk gap, you must always cross these states that are at the surface. And that means that you have states that are both filled and empty near the Fermi level, and therefore conduction. So this is my naive picture of this. I think that the statement that the states built of S orbitals must connect to those built of S orbitals, I'd like to have a crisper explanation for it. But in any case, if we accept that these must connect, then that's what gives, for me, the name topological, because this is like a string, and if we, no matter how we wiggle that string, we can't avoid the fact that we must cut it if we put the Fermi level in the gap. So somewhere near the interface between these two materials, we must get a 2D electron system at the surface. The fact that that you can bring the valence band up to become the conduction band, at least in existing systems, that always comes from spin orbit coupling, which affects the valence band more strongly than the conduction band, and in some cases can push it up substantially. It's possible, in addition to having this 2D electron system, which turns out to be a Dirac system with real spin as opposed to graphene's pseudo-spin lattice index, in addition to that, there are predictions that one could get more exotic particles emerging in these sorts of systems, including something that I'll allude to today, Majorana fermions, but also magnetic monopoles. So things that came up in the context of particle physics, but now have some interesting meaning in condensed matter. So what actual systems show this sort of behavior? I guess, is there a way to get this light off, or? Great, thank you. I think that will be very useful because we experimentalists like to show things that are dim but not quite black, and now you can see them. So this is not my work. This is work from Yulin Chen and ZX Shen at Stanford. On photo emission spectroscopy. There's also been important work in this area done at Princeton and other places. I'm now going to describe what I'd call the hydrogen atom of topological insulators, of 3D topological insulators, and that's bismuth selenide. So bismuth selenide, its structure is layered. So it goes selenium, bismuth, selenium, bismuth, selenium, and then that repeats. The unit cell is not actually just one of these layers, but for practical purposes, we can consider this as the basic layer. This quintuple layer is about 1 nanometer thick. The interaction between the selenium and the selenium is quite weak, so it's easy to make atomically flat surfaces by cleaving the crystal. And because of that, there have been really very successful studies using surface-sensitive probes. So here, I'm showing you photo emission spectroscopy. So this is basically measuring what energy and momentum states electrons were in before they were kicked out by an X-ray. And so you can see that there are bulk valence bands here at low energies. Then there's a bulk conduction band at high energies. And then in between, if you look closely, you can see that there are a couple of lines coming through here. Those are surface states, and in fact, the so-called Dirac surface states, which cross here at the Dirac point. Now, it's not the absolutely perfect realization of this. It's not as perfect as graphene in some ways, because you can see that these bands are not linear. They're definitely curving as they're going through zero. This system is nice because it has a relatively large bulk gap at a few hundred millielectron volts. The Dirac point is in the gap as opposed to buried in one of the bulk bands. And so, and there's just one Dirac point at the surface. So, and it's at zero momentum. So this is, at least from a theoretical point of view, a very nice simple system. And in studies by photoemission spectroscopy, by the way, you notice that the Fermi level in this study was way up here in the bulk conduction band. That was intentionally done in order to have all these states filled so that you could knock out electrons from them, because if a state is not filled, you can't knock out an electron, you can't detect it with photoemission. But it's also going to be a harbinger of things to come, the fact that the Fermi level is not necessarily in the gap. So photoemission spectroscopy has been powerful. People have also done beautiful STM studies on these surfaces. So the surface sensitive studies have shown a lot, including the spin structure of the surface states. There's a pretty large gap, but whenever we do transport measurements, we always get some bulk conduction as well as surface conduction. And so that's going to be a recurring theme of what I'll talk about, but in the end, we just sort of throw up our hands and say, there's going to be some bulk conduction, let's still try to study the surface. The structure is layered. As I mentioned, you can get atomically flat surfaces, which is good for these surface studies, but it's also good because we learned how to, from graphene, how to put scotch tape on things and peel them and get thin layers. And if the bulk conduction is substantial, we can try to cut it down by making a thinner layer. Then there's less bulk compared to surface.
In that case, Dirac point is gap.
So the point made was, when you make things thin, the Dirac point is gapped. That's true if you make it thin enough. Actually, my original motivation for trying to study thin layers of bismuth selenide was indeed exactly what you said, to try to bring the top layer and bottom layer close together so that they could tunnel to each other, form bonding and anti-bonding states, if you think of it like being two atoms in a molecule, and then you would indeed gap out the 2D states. However, that, at least the predictions for that, and I would say the experiments mostly match that, is that you need to go down to three or four single layers. So three or four of these quintuple layers. Whereas the work that I'll show you today ranges, we've gone down to four layers, but it's mostly tens of layers or even hundreds of layers. But still, that's a lot less than if you take 100 microns or something like that. Yeah. So let me tell you where we're going. First, I'm going to give you some of the nitty-gritty details of how transport actually works in these so-called topologically insulating materials. I would say that for now, a better name for them might be topologically heavily doped semiconductors. Which is doesn't have quite the same ring to it, but we're working on it. So I'll talk about how the materials are made, how we can push around large charge densities and hence sort of modulate the surface transport and to some extent the bulk transport, how we can try to get rid of some of the doping in the bulk, and then I'm going to move to what I think is the newer and more interesting physics here, and that's what happens if we make superconducting contacts to these samples. That's, from a theoretical point of view, been very interesting because of the interfaces between the superconductor and perhaps the proximity-induced superconductivity in one of these topological materials. And so I'll show you measurements on about 15 samples that we've made measuring supercurrents in this material, and it turns out that the junctions look very different from ordinary superconductor, normal superconductor junctions, and not entirely in ways that we understand. So here's a flake, here's a crystal of bismuth selenide grown by Jim Analytis in Ian Fisher's group at Stanford. The scale is about a millimeter, or maybe even a few millimeters in this case. And a few hundred microns thick. They're grown by flowing gases through a hot furnace, and then as the bismuth and selenium get to cooler parts of the furnace, they condense and form these crystals. There are other ways to grow these crystals by sort of melt-based techniques and fineness. And finally, people are now around the world, I'd say probably around 20 people have destroyed their MBE systems by putting this, or for any other purpose, by putting these high vapor pressure materials in them. So there's a range of exciting ways to make these materials. It turns out that if you just naively make bismuth selenide crystals, they tend to be pretty heavily doped, typically about 10 to the 18 per centimeter cubed. And Ian Fisher's group, I feel, really pioneered getting down that doping by trying a range of substitution strategies, and I think the most effective was substituting tin for some of the a small amount of the bismuth. It's supposed to be isoelectronic, but it turns out that it reduces the n-type doping, and you get about 5 times 10 to the 16 per centimeter cubed. So that's a relatively, it's not as low as you can get in the best semiconductors, but it's pretty nice. And if you think about going down to a thickness of 100 nanometers, then you actually get quite a low 2D density from it. Unfortunately, that's where the good news ends, but I'll tell you that in a moment. So what we do is take one of these crystals, put scotch tape on it, peel it off, put the tape with the flakes onto a silicon oxide substrate, peel it off again, and we're left with flakes of a range of thicknesses. My group in particular has never gotten single monolayer flakes. We've gotten down to about single quintuple layers. We've gotten down to about 4 quintuple layers, 4 nanometers, but mostly thicker layers, and that's fine for the work that I'll talk about. So we get these flakes that, at least if we're allowing them to be 10 to 100 nanometers thick, then we can get them to be tens of microns in size. And then we put down leads using electron beam lithography, and we measure transport in them. By the way, in the title here, I've mentioned one other material in this family, the 221 bismuth tellurium selenide material, which is supposed to have the top and bottom selenium layer replaced with tellurium. It's probably not quite as stoichiometric as that, but it's interesting because it seems to have less bulk conductivity. And this was first introduced by Ando, but also studied by Ong, and we're studying it. So what does this exfoliation do? We get really flat surfaces. So this is just a rough AFM image of a flake with 2 terraces. And you can see that you have a very flat terrace, then you jump down, you have again another very flat terrace, then you jump down. And I don't want to claim that this is flat really to the level that that you can study in STM, but people also do the same thing with STM and find extremely large flat terraces. And as I said, we've made a range of different thicknesses of flakes. This is not, you know, there's a little bit of design in how you exfoliate, but mostly it's just you then search for what you want on the flake, on the silicon oxide you deposited onto. You get 4 nanometers to about half a micron thick. So once you have these, as I mentioned, they tend to be doped. But I suggest that maybe it's not so bad. Once you have gotten the bulk doping down, you get these low doping densities. Unfortunately, that doesn't really seem to help as much as you would hope. And even in very thin layers, you get large 2D densities, which are in a substantial part of that is from the bulk. And so we'll talk about that as we go along. Here are just a couple of examples of groups doing trying to manipulate these densities. So you have a thin bismuth selenide flake, an oxide layer, typically a high dielectric constant, and then a gate on the surface. You may also use a gate on the back of the sample. This is work by Hadar Steinberg from Pablo Jarillo Herrero's group at MIT. And then you do transport measurements as a function of these gate voltages. You can see that Pablo's group was able to get a very small modulation of the resistance of the sample, a few percent, as a function of gate voltage, by sweeping this top gate that's very strongly coupled. So that suggests that there's a pretty high density, there's a pretty high density of conducting carriers in parallel if they're only able to make a few percent modulation, even though they go through a maximum in resistance, which suggests that they're sweeping through the gap. There's some very nice results from Michael Fuhrer's group at Maryland, Kim et al. They used a clever technique, which I think is very broadly applicable, not just to these materials, which is to put a drop of an electrolyte on the surface and then manipulate the ions in the electrolyte in order to put positive or negative carriers right on top of the channel. This is called electrolytic gating. My group has recently done some work on this in complex oxides, and I think that it's a way to push around carrier densities up to 10 to the 15 per centimeter squared, so much higher than you can do with ordinary gates. So they use a two-step process. One is to use this electrolytic gating to tune the density of carriers in the system, and then they use a back gate. Once they're at relatively low density, they use a back gate to change the density and sweep across the Dirac point. I'm claiming that this is the Dirac point. At least it's somewhere in the gap. You see that there's a maximum in the resistivity. It's much stronger than you saw in the work from the MIT group. And a nice thing that they add is doing a Hall measurement and seeing that as a function of the backgate voltage, once they've gotten to relatively low density, as a function of the backgate voltage, the density extracted from the Hall effect goes linearly. And then once you get close to zero density, you can't extract a density anymore. You probably have both positive and negative carriers. And then you go across this gap. So they correlated Hall behavior with ordinary longitudinal resistivity and really showed that they could sweep across the gap of the system and probably presumably then across the Dirac point. So there are complexities in all of this about you have several parallel conducting layers, the back surface, the bulk, the top surface. And so the MIT group did a nice job of trying to separate these out. One thing I should mention is you might think that if you have a surface conductor and you put a gate on top, you're only going to affect the surface density. In fact, that's not true because a 2D conductor doesn't screen perfectly, and especially when you get near the Dirac point, you have zero density of states in the surface, so your field does penetrate into the bulk. But in any case, you can push charges around, and that's a good thing because even after this electrolytic gating, for example, you can see that it required 100 volts or 80 volts on the top on the back gate, which is sweeping nearly 10 to the 13 electrons per centimeter squared in order to get to the Dirac point. So it's not, in fact, you can see that from the Hall measurements also, that you're pushing around 10 to the 13 electrons per centimeter squared. And that's about as much as you can do with a conventional gate. So there's a large density of carriers. We've also done work on gating, and you can see that if we use just the back gate, we can go from having n-type carriers to getting the resistance going up substantially, a factor of three or so, to, you know, in this case, on the order of the quantum of resistance. And we can at least approach the gap, but we can't quite clearly get there. And if we add a top gate, then so we use both the back gate and the top gate. Now we can go across the maximum and back on the other side. And so we too can push around densities around 10 to the 13 per centimeter squared. But again, there's a lot of doping. There are large carrier density before we start sweeping. We're not near the Dirac point. And unfortunately, we and almost everyone else has quite low mobility in the surface states. Compared to the systems that I'm spoiled with, the gallium arsenide and even graphene, I think this will improve over time. And Alberto Morpurgo has done one nice study that seems to show higher mobility in surface states. But magnetic field has little effect in this particular sample.
Can you give us some numbers, like how the mobilities compare?
Yeah, so the mobility, I would say ours gets up to maybe 1,000, and Alberto seems to be a factor of a few higher than that.
And in graphene, what's
the in graphene, I would say that people now frequently get mobilities of 10,000. People get mobilities up to 20,000 on silicon oxide. If you put the graphene, if you suspend it or put it on boron nitride, a very flat and charge-free and defect-free substrate, then mobilities get up in the range of 50,000, maybe even higher. You have to be careful when someone working on graphene mentions a mobility, you need to check your wallet because they basically they may be saying, well, at the Dirac point, the conductivity is the following value and the density is zero, so let's divide this conductivity by zero and we get a very high number, and so that's something to be careful of. You can't directly compare a mobility that one person reports to another unless they are clear about their procedure for extracting it. But but in any case, we're this is newer than graphene, but I think it's always going to be behind graphene unless the MBE work gets very successful, because graphene, I thought graphene is completely two-dimensional. It's all surface. It's very sensitive to the outside world, and that's all true, but it's also chemically very robust. So things adsorb on the surface, but you can also just burn them off. So that's not the case with bismuth selenide. You can't heat it up without getting selenium to go out and get vacancies, which dope the system. So this is, I don't want you to really need to look at the details of this slide, but this is just showing that we measure, say eight samples and see and get a peak in resistance in each of them as a function of gating. The peaks in resistance can range from close to the conductance quantum to substantially lower than that. And it doesn't really seem to depend on either the length between the contacts or the thickness of the sample in a systematic way. So this is something suggesting that there's something out of our control, which is almost certainly doping, that's causing this variation in behavior. Because if you have an uncontrolled bulk conduction that's in parallel with your surface conduction, then you're not going to get a very high peak resistance because you have some other channel to go through. So a likely culprit, probably the main culprit, is exposure to air. So this is work, again, from Yulin Chen at Stanford, showing that if he keeps a sample in ultra-high vacuum, this is 4 times 10 to the 11 torr, but even ultra-high vacuum has some contaminants in it, then using photoemission spectroscopy, it's possible to look at what the Fermi level is relative to the Dirac point, and then to track that over time. And if you look at that, then you see that in 2 hours, the Fermi level moves by 50 millielectron volts relative to the Dirac point. And that's 2 hours in this extremely low pressure environment. And in fact, it does scale with the pressure. It becomes twice as long if you reduce the pressure by a factor of two. And this also, you can also look at this and not shine the x-rays all the time and see that it's not that you're damaging it by x-rays. So there's something that's getting onto the surface, you freshly cleave, and then you'd better get started right away. So it may seem that then things are entirely hopeless if you're bringing the sample out into air at all, because something happens in 2 hours at these tiny pressures, it'll happen immediately in the air. That's true at some level, but it's there's also some hope. For example, Jim Analytis has brought samples down to the National High Magnetic Field Lab at Tallahassee and found that the behavior he got at Stanford was fine, but then when he exposed the samples for a few hours to extremely high humidities, it got worse. So at least, maybe we can't make it better, but we can certainly make it worse. So that suggests that we might try to limit the exposure to air and water even more. One approach to this is to try to encapsulate the sample, to sort of put a a Band-Aid on top of it to prevent exposure to air. This is actually a 2-to-1 compound. This is the bismuth fluorine selenide. And now we can measure transport in a region that's covered, and a region that's not covered. This we use as a polymer called PDMS that's used a lot in microfluidics. So if you people make lab on a chip sort of things, they use this sort of rubbery polymer. And we can compare the transport in the two areas, and we find the geometry is not perfect, but we find that when we make Hall measurements in encapsulated and non-encapsulated areas, we find that there's almost a factor of two difference in the density that we measure. And so that's that tells us, all right, we are really having an effect by, and this is an inferred 3D density. So we, of course, we measure a 2D density, but we use the device thickness and just assume that the carriers are uniform. But if we change our approach and assume that the difference between the encapsulated and non-encapsulated regions is entirely in the top 10 nanometers, which seems reasonable from other studies, then what we're seeing is that when we encapsulate, the density near the surface is actually reduced by a factor of 10. So this is, you know, it's just one little study. It's not something that I want to make much of, but I think there is hope for doing encapsulation. So this was where we cleaved the sample in a dry environment in a nitrogen dry box and then covered it up before we brought it out into the air. So I think there's some hope for that. But in the rest of the talk, I'm going to just go full speed ahead saying, let's just have an exposed surface, realize that we may have some bulk conduction, and see what we can get with contacting this material with superconductors. So now we're now changing gears. And so if you think about what happens if you take a metal and put a superconductor near it, as you know, the superconductor produces a pairing within the metal. So you still have the ordinary quasiparticles, but you also have pairing in the metal, which allows it to have a supercurrent. It changes its density of states. So this metal is a hybrid of an ordinary metal and a superconductor. So if we think in the context of exotic metals and exotic superconductors, so about a decade ago, Kataev looked at what you should get if you take a 1D quantum wire. So this is an ordinary metal, let's say, although you can consider it to be ballistic, let's say, but a 1D conductor, ordinary conductor, on a three-dimensional unconventional superconductor, P plus IP. There are various candidates, including a strontium ruthenate compound, but I would say there's no really conclusive proof of it, and I'd be happy to have someone suggest otherwise. This is not my expertise, but there's a range of interesting measurements on strontium ruthenate compounds, that some of which suggest that the theory that it should be P plus IP is correct. So this 1D conductor has proximity-induced superconductivity, and it turns out that at the ends of this conductor, you should have bound states at zero energy. One way of thinking about this is that if you have superconductivity, then you have particle hole symmetry. So if there's a state at a certain energy, there's another state at negative that energy. If you further assume that you have a state at zero energy, then it has to be its own antiparticle, because there has to be another state at that zero energy. And these kinds of states are fermions that are their own antiparticles, are called Majorana fermions. They were first introduced in particle physics, and in fact, I would say especially until neutrinos were found to have a mass, but perhaps still, it may be that neutrinos are Majorana particles. That is, that they're that an electron neutrino is the same particle as an electron antineutrino, just with opposite helicity. So this was sort of a motivation for some of the ideas in this field. And you see that this was a normal metal on an unconventional superconductor, but it turns out you should be able to get basically the same effect anytime you have an interface between a conventional and an unconventional superconductor. And so you could make the superconductor an ordinary superconductor and the metal an unconventional metal. So that's what we'll look at. So here's our 1D chain that should have these at the edges or at the boundaries between the induced superconductor and the bulk. You should have these zero energy states. Now let's ask, what happens if we, instead of having a 1D system, let's broaden it out to two dimensions. So instead of having, let's say, superconductor, normal, superconductor, let's make the superconductor fat, spread it out into 2D, and make the normal system also 2D. And in that case, instead of having just a single Majorana state at each interface, we should have a Majorana wire that disperses along this interface. And so, so work by Titov from Banneker's group and by Lang Fu and Charlie Kane showed that that these states which live in the gap should have a dispersion as a function of their momentum in this direction. And in a certain special circumstance, that dispersion should be linear. It should be a Dirac dispersion. But that's only when the phase between the two superconductors is pi. In other cases, you should have a gap dispersion. So so in any case, I would say that experimentalists have been very excited to think about how we might try to study these states that live in the gap. And probably most of the work in that area has gone toward something more like the Kataev idea. Well, it's actually yet a different idea where you have a 1D wire, but the 1D wire has spin orbit coupling and you can induce a gap in it. So I won't discuss that too much, but I think that it's not yet clear what should be the signatures of these zero energy states and of this dispersion. There are ideas ranging from doing tunneling spectroscopy and looking at the a peak in the density of states to, well, I guess that's probably the most dominant idea. But what we're going to do is to try to build this system and measure transport and especially supercurrent from one superconducting lead to another. Just to be clear, we're not measuring transport along these putative wires, we're measuring transport across them. So what's been measured up to now with superconducting contacts on topological insulators? This is mostly bismuth selenide, one work on bismuth telluride. So if you take the differential resistance, the derivative of voltage with respect to current as a function of the voltage applied or the current driven, this is work from Alberto Morporgo's group at Geneva. And what you see is that at low voltage, you get a sharp dip in the resistance. It doesn't go quite to zero, so they're not really cleanly seeing a supercurrent, but it's at least getting close. And they also see a lot of other interesting features at higher voltage. There's work from Moses Chan's group at Penn State looking at aluminum contacts to bismuth selenide. That's the same material system as here, but the contacts are spaced farther. Here it was 100 nanometers or so. Here it's a micron, and what they see is interesting and a bit surprising. That's when you look at the linear resistance for the system, they never see a supercurrent, but when the aluminum goes below the critical temperature, the resistance goes up by 10% or so, 10-20%. And they call this inverse proximity effect. It's clearly associated with the turn on of superconductivity. For example, they can kill it by putting on a very small magnetic field. Then you see no feature because the aluminum never goes superconducting. So this is intriguing. There's work from Nitin Samarth at Penn State on showing and this is not with aluminum contacts, but rather tungsten contacts. And there, again, they don't see a clear critical current, clear supercurrent, but they do see multiple Andreev reflections. For those of you who are familiar with this, that these are ways that when you drive a current, an electron can bounce back and forth between the two electrodes, gaining a certain amount of energy each time. Sorry, when you apply a voltage between the two electrodes, every time the electron bounces back and forth, it can gain an energy equal to the voltage, and so you can get peaks where when you bounce back and forth a number of times, you gain the full gap, superconducting gap energy. So this is familiar in other systems, but it's nice to see here. And then just about a week ago, there was posted on the archive work from the Institute of Physics in Beijing, showing that if you make contacts, this is to bismuth telluride, and you look at the, you can get a supercurrent, and if you look at the magnetic field dependence, you see the classic behavior, which is that when you put one flux through the junction, you kill the supercurrent, and then it recovers, and you kill it again. Basically, this diffraction pattern is analogous to the diffraction pattern of light from a slit, and I'll be talking more about this. The point to make here is that they see exactly what you'd expect. In fact, it's a really beautiful example of a classic Fraunhofer diffraction pattern. So that's setting the stage. What we do is to take an exfoliated flake of bismuth selenide, typically around 100 nanometers thick, but varying from tens of nanometers to probably 150 nanometers. We make aluminum contacts. You can see we put aluminum over almost the entire thing, but if you look closely, there's a little spacing between the two aluminum leads here. The spacing is very small, tens of nanometers. We've chosen between 30 and 80 nanometers for different samples. And we slid out the leads on each side so we can drive a current and also measure a voltage, and so we don't deal with voltage drops outside this little narrow region. So the contacts are really important, and so to get good contact, we use a thin titanium layer and then an aluminum layer. There are various possible reasons why this helps. It may be that titanium sucks in oxygen, but still produces a conducting layer, whereas aluminum oxide is an insulator. So it may be work function issues, but in any case, I don't know in detail, but it may also actually be adhesion or sticking that the titanium helps, but that's important. So if we think about what are the characteristic length scales here, we've chosen to make this very short so that it should be smaller than the mean free path and also smaller than the coherence length in the 2D layer here. So Ong's group last year in Science extracted a surface quantum scattering length of about 200 nanometers. So the quantum scattering length is a lower bound for the mean free path. So the mean free path should be at least that 200 nanometers. And in order for, if we extract a coherence length in the bismuth selenide layer from that, we would get about a micron. And we're less than a tenth of that separation. So unless we have a much lower quality surface, our leads should be within a coherence length of each other. And in fact, that's borne out by the fact that we see no systematic difference as we vary the separation between leads. When we go to a micron, we do see a different behavior. So so we have these contacts. Oh, I should mention, just to be clear, I showed this geometry before, but we have very wide leads that are separated by a small length. So I'll call this wide, this large dimension the width, and that's ranged between a half micron and 3 microns now in our measurements. So what do the measurements look like? At zero magnetic field, we see as we drive a current, we see no voltage, and then the voltage jumps to a finite value. So we have a resistive state. Typical critical currents might be around a microamp in these junctions. We come back, there's no hysteresis. It follows exactly time after time. That tells us that this is an overdamped junction, although it's a little bit unusual in an overdamped junction to have such a sharp jump here, and so that's something, if people have ideas, I'd still be interested. If we look at the effect of magnetic field, as we turn on magnetic field, we suppress the supercurrent, it gets smaller and smaller, till by a few millitesla, we have just a linear current voltage characteristic. When we heat things up, these measurements are done in the dilution refrigerator, carefully filtered. We have a base temperature about 12 millikelvin. When we heat things up, it takes till about 200 millikelvin before we substantially change the critical current, and then it keeps going down and down. But interestingly, we do see a critical current all the way up to 1 Kelvin when the aluminum goes stops being superconducting. So there's only one transition temperature for turning on a supercurrent, and that's the aluminum transition. Whereas I think some ideas have suggested that you might have induced superconductivity with a smaller gap. That doesn't appear to be the case here. So if we look carefully, here we have the derivative of what I showed before, which we measure using a locking technique. You have zero resistance until you get to on order a microamp, and then you have a jump in resistance, and then there are other interesting features that are actually very consistent from sample to sample, but I don't want to emphasize those. I want to focus on just this gap in supercurrents. I guess I'll mention one thing about the higher energy features. Here, if we plot against the applied voltage, or the voltage across the junction instead of the current across the junction, then the zero resistance state collapses to just one point, but it allows us to look at the energy scale of these features, and it turns out that these peaks are at 2 times the gap of aluminum. We're trying to understand these shoulder features also, which are very consistent from sample to sample. But again, let's focus on this supercurrent and this gap. So if we look at what's the critical current, the critical current for a Josephson junction of any kind is, if we multiply that critical current by the normal state resistance, we get an energy scale. The critical current times the normal state resistance times a charge gives us an energy scale, and roughly that should be the gap in this in the superconducting leads. We can be more precise. There's theory by Kulik, and I'm always forgetting the name of his coworker, for superconducting normal superconducting junctions, and it differs a little bit depending on whether it's ballistic or diffusive. But basically, on a log scale, these two look very similar, and both of them say that the critical current as a function of normal state resistance should be way up here, and instead we find an order of magnitude lower. Fine, you might say. You might say, well, critical current in Josephson junctions can often be suppressed. You can't get it higher than it should be, but there are lots of things that can suppress it. We've gone through those in detail, and I think we've ruled them all, the main ones out. So you can be hotter than you think because there are excitations that come down your lines. We've done very careful filtering. We see that in well-characterized junctions, aluminum oxide junctions, we don't have these effects. Also, for an overdamped junction, we'd have to be heated to 2 Kelvin to see this much suppression in the supercurrent. So that's really not likely. It could be that the junction is much longer than the coherence length, but as I've mentioned, well, all of these samples here, they range from 30 to 80 nanometers, and there's no systematic variation with the spacing of the junction, the length of the junction. There's just a variation of critical current with normal state resistance. So we think that it's not an accident that the critical current is lower, and we'd like to understand that. So that's the first puzzle. The next thing, all of these junctions, although they had different lengths, they all had 1 micron width. Now let's look at what happens if we vary the width of the junction, and think for a moment about what you'd expect in the product of critical current and normal state resistance if you vary the width of the junction. So you make the junction twice as wide, your critical current should get twice as big. Your normal state resistance should drop by a factor of 2 because it's twice as wide. So the product, again, I mentioned before, it should be roughly the gap in the leads. It shouldn't change with that geometry. So let's test that and see what happens. And so here's what happens. If you look at the product of critical current and normal state resistance as a function of 1 over the width of the sample, as I said, we go from about 3 micron width down to half a micron width, you see that there's a very strong systematic behavior. And at the level of these data, I can basically just draw a line through these samples. These were our first samples, which were all 1 micron width. And then we've taken other samples at other widths. I should mention one of these samples was grown by a different method, by vapor liquid solid growth, which is often used to make nanowires. This is done by Yichui's group at Stanford, and it falls right on this dependence. So so it seems like the one thing that matters is the width. There's also one device in Alberto Morpurgo's paper, and that's also would fit right on this dependence. So basically, it seems like the width is the one number we need for this, and that's for 14 devices here. Just to make this really crisp, let's look at two samples that had the same normal state resistance. So if you look at the voltage as a function of current, at high current, it looks exactly the same for these two devices, but one of them was half micron width and one micron width. Why do they have the same supercurrent? We don't know. There's a variation in the normal in the quality of the contacts from one sample to another. So it turns out these two with different widths have the same normal state resistance. However, the one that's narrower has twice the critical current. So so this is striking, and I think this is the second part of the first puzzle. So now let's go to the second puzzle. That is the magnetic field dependence of the critical current. If you take an ordinary Josephson junction, as we already saw in the examples, you get, when you put one superconducting flux quantum through the junction, you completely kill the critical current. And the reason is that you have a phase that is, you have a current that flows on the left side, on the top of the junction and the bottom of the junction that are opposite. So you get this zero, but this is not an Aharonov-Bohm ring. It doesn't have one well-defined area. So if you put a little more flux through, then you can see you're going to get more than one full sine wave fitting in here, and therefore you start to get again a critical current that can flow here, through here. So there are two important things about this pattern. One is the position of the first zero. That should always be when you have one flux quantum through the junction. The other thing is the spacing of these zeros. They should be uniformly spaced except that there's no zero at zero flux, zero magnetic field. So this should be twice the spacing and then 1, 1, 1. So let's look at what we see for our devices. Here's a color scale of the differential resistance as a function of magnetic field and current flowing through. So white is the regions where we have supercurrent. So you can see we have this big lobe and then another one and then maybe another one on the side. There are three things that are strange about this. One, as I'll show you, the field scale is wrong for the size of these devices. Secondly, the spacing is not the way you'd expect for the classic Fraunhofer pattern. And third, I won't give any explanation to this at all, but there are new features that are very consistent that we don't expect. So let's look at the first aspect. Sketched here is what we'd expect as the Fraunhofer pattern, just the middle lobe for the actual device area. And here we've taken into account the fact that that field can penetrate into the superconductor. So we've taken into account the London penetration depth. We didn't take into account flux focusing, which I learned about earlier this week, but that only makes a very small change here. And what you can see is that you've gone through 1, 2, 3 lobes and still haven't gotten to where you should be at the first zero. It turns out that if you look at it carefully, the scale is off for all devices by at least a factor of 5. And so you need to put less flux in than you would expect to kill the supercurrent. That's rather surprising. Now let's just try to say, well, let's suppose we somehow got this wrong, even though we've made, I guess now 15 devices, and this is consistent across all of them. Let's just try to fit the central lobe. If we try to fit the central lobe, then you see that you should have 2 lobes within within the next lobe. And so the twice the width, 1 times the width, 1 times the width simply doesn't work. So that pattern is also off. And I would say that my understanding is that Fraunhofer patterns for junctions are not always perfect and classic. However, they're rarely very consistent from one device to another, and yet different in these ways. And so this is different from the paper that was posted on the archive on bismuth telluride, which showed a completely classic Fraunhofer pattern with the right scales. So there are also, if you do a cut at finite magnetic field, you see that there are these extra features, sort of shadows of the killing of the supercurrent there, where you no longer have a supercurrent, but probably it still relates to the superconductivity. We don't understand that. So the Fraunhofer pattern is, I would say, the second set of puzzles. So we want to understand a few things. One is why the critical current is too small by an order of magnitude. Why, as we change the width of the junction, the critical current scales as 1 over the width. And finally, why the Fraunhofer patterns, the magnetic field dependence, are not like typical Josephson junctions. So I'm going to now tell a story, which is motivated by theoretical ideas, but as far as I know, has not been suggested by any theorist. And certainly, you may find that there are key things that are inconsistent with the typical view of things. So let's return to the Fu and Kane picture, where you have these 2 superconducting leads and should have these Majorana wires going along here. If the phase difference is pi, then you should have these linearly dispersing modes within the gap. And then we can ask, how does this interact with the supercurrent? And as far as I know, this is not a question that's really been seriously addressed. So let me mention one thing. You know, here I'm saying the phase between the superconductors is pi. We're not controlling the phase, and so it's not necessarily exactly pi. But for these types of junctions, it's expected that we should not just have the sinusoidal current phase relationship, but something that's more sawtooth-like, which should push the phase close to pi for these junctions. So this is not a crazy assumption, won't be exactly pi, but it's a starting point. So if we have these leads are only finite width, then it means that this wire has only a finite length. So if we just say, let's quantize this particle in a box quantization with a linear dispersion instead of the typical quadratic dispersion that we have for the Schrodinger equation, then we can answer what should be the spacing of these energies. And the answer is that spacing of the energies should be Planck's constant times the velocity of these Majorana modes divided by 2 times the width. So you see that this has something that goes as 1 over width. So that's sort of suggestive. We're looking at patterns. So we noticed that there was an energy scale, critical current times normal state resistance, that goes as 1 over the width in our measurements. So here's an energy scale that goes as 1 over the width that comes out of the theory. But what does it have to do with what we're measuring? So let's ask which of these states should exist. First of all, my understanding is that the zero state should remain, should not be upon quantization. I mean, if you think about it naively, we shrink everything down to 1D in this direction instead of 2D, we get back to something more like the Kataev picture, where you should still have this zero energy state. So this one should remain there, I believe. But we should then have only certain K values allowed, and therefore only certain energies above there. So if we say that this doesn't really interact with the supercurrent. Either it carries the supercurrent or doesn't cause dissipation, but these higher energy states cause dissipation. Again, I don't think that this is suggested theoretically, but if these cause dissipation, then once we got to an energy scale that could start exciting these modes, then we might kill the supercurrent. So, and we would hit that energy scale at an energy that that goes as 1/1. So that that seems to have some nice meshing with what we're measuring. But if you look at this, you see that there's Planck's constant, which we know. There's the width, which we know. And then there's the velocity of the Majoranas. So that's going to tell you what the slope of this is. And you might imagine that that's simply the velocity of the Dirac particles in the 2D surface of bismuth selenide, which is reasonably well known to within a factor of a few. I thought it was better than that, but it's there's some uncertainty of those numbers if you compare different measurements. But basically, we know the velocity of the Dirac particles on the surface, but actually these should be much lower velocity. And a naive way to see this is that as these modes propagate along this direction, they should be bouncing back and forth and having multiple Andreev reflections, and this will slow them down. So how much should they be slowed down? In the work by Fu and Kane, they predicted that they should slow down. Also in the work by Titov and Banneker, they predicted that that these modes should slow down. But they got different results. So let me give you the results that gives the right answer for us. And then of course this is a matter of, you know, there are two different calculations, and one of them, at least one of them, is wrong. I guess it's not proven that both of them are right, but sorry, that it could be that both of them are wrong, but at least one of them is wrong, because they took the same basic model. So what Titov claimed was that the slowing down of these modes, they should be slowed down by a ratio of the gap in the superconductor to the Fermi energy measured relative to the Dirac point in the surface state. So the I guess I can just say it. So the gap in the superconductor, the gap is roughly the critical temperature. So in aluminum, 100 microelectron volts. I can never remember the conversion factor, but between the energy scale of TC and the energy scale of the gap. But say 100 microvolts. We're going to be dealing with orders of magnitude here. The Fermi energy for these typical systems, because they're not right at the Dirac point, they're doped. Typical energy is 100 millielectron volts. So 100 microvolts over 100 millivolts is 3 orders of magnitude. If you slow down the surface states by 3 orders of magnitude to get the velocity of these Majoranas, you get about 10^4 meters per second. And this is close to the estimate, 10^4 meters per second. And that turns out to be exactly what we need to get the right slope here, to get our 1/1 dependence to actually give us the right critical current. So that's pretty striking. Of course, if you use Fu and Kane's result, you would get another, it turns out, instead of getting the gap divided by the chemical potential, they have the gap divided by the chemical potential squared as a prefactor. And so that would give us 10 meters per second, which would be much too flat a dispersion. So I think that this needs to be checked. I don't know which is right or whether either of them is right. But if you take the what's 3 orders of magnitude between friends? But if you take the work from Banneker's group, then you get phenomenologically the right scale for giving us the 1/1 dependence. And so that's striking. You know, it may be a pattern that we've seen correctly, but has nothing to do with the physics I just said. But I think it's an interesting connection. We don't have as good an understanding of what's happening with the field dependence, except that in order to get a narrowing of the central peak, you have to have a current phase relationship that's peaked around some particular phase. And in fact, my postdoc Jimmy Williams has been able to get some of the features of this narrow dependence by taking a instead of taking an ordinary sinusoidal current phase relationship for a junction, taking a narrower peak that's around in current current as a function of phase at a particular phase. So I think we're going to work on, and I'd welcome help in working on how we take a Fraunhofer pattern and try to recover a current phase relationship. But it's clearly an unusual current phase relationship, and it may have to do with the zero mode remaining as we go to these finite widths of the wire. The zero mode may give interesting features in the current phase relationship, but I don't know what it would do. So to wrap things up, we've shown that we can gate topological insulator materials, and we need to if we want to get rid of the bulk conduction and push around the surface states. But we've seen that the surface can contribute significantly to transport. It's not all of the transport, but it can be a large part of the transport. We've measured superconducting devices that are either ballistic or near ballistic. I should say, I just talked with Shafiq Adam last week, and he claimed that the way everyone tries to extract the scattering lengths in these surface states is wrong, and that he'll show this soon. So it may be that I'm a bit off in claiming that this is ballistic, but it certainly seems that we're within the coherence length because the separation of our leads doesn't matter. The junctions on bismuth selenide look not at all like ordinary SNS junctions in a number of ways, but there are a lot of consistencies between one device and the next, and systematic behaviors. And the departures from ordinary behavior, well, I wouldn't say we've explained them, but we've made a hand-waving connection to quantization of states in a Majorana wire in the junction, and I think it's an intriguing thing to follow up. What's the interaction of a supercurrent with the Majorana states? So what made this work happen? The real driver of the work was my postdoc, Jimmy Williams, who's absolutely fabulous. He's also done exciting work on 2D complex oxide systems with electrolytic gating that was just in PRL in this last week, and also did a lot of the early work on graphene when he was in Charlie Marcus's group to show the behavior of the direct fermions in PN junctions. Andrew Bestwick, a really excellent grad student, and Patrick Gallagher, an amazing undergrad who's now a grad student at Harvard. And Patrick actually was a finalist for the APS APRA Award in part because of his work on the early stages of this project. The growth was done mainly by Jim Analytis in Ian Fisher's group, but as I mentioned, we're also collaborating with a range of people in each ways group on a different kind of way of making these small structures. We've had very useful input from a number of people, but especially from John Clark and Jed Johnson at Berkeley, Mac Beasley at Stanford, and Shaolan Chi at Stanford, although he seems to be more often here these days. The importance of this is that a year ago, Jimmy and I knew very little about superconductors beyond coursework. Amazingly, Jimmy has come up to speed and is making world-class junctions, and I think has also a deep understanding of this material. So with that, let me wrap up, and I welcome any questions.
I have two questions. One is the notion of this proximity-induced gapping. That is not part of the SNS junction thinking, or is it? That's one question. And second question is, has there been any experiments on putting superconductor on top of graphene?
Okay,
similar geometry.
So the first. First question, proximity-induced gapping, could you explicate a little more what you were asking about?
I mean, there Earlier in your talk, you mentioned writing down the Hamiltonian that in a normal system, you will induce a gap by bringing a superconductor. Now, that aspect of that notion did not seem to play any role in just thinking about the Josephson junction. Because usually when I think about Josephson, not that I know a whole lot, but when I think about a Josephson junction, I say, okay, I've got a superconductor, I've got a normal metal or insulator and a superconductor, and I ask what's the phase relationship and the phase current relationship.
Yes, so that's a fair question. So the question is, does it really matter whether the normal metal is turned in a certain sense into a superconductor or not? So if you were to take, to tunnel into the, so just making an NS junction, and you were to tunnel into the normal metal near the superconductor, then you would see a gap in the density of states, and you'd see presence of density of states, but you'd see a rise in the density of states at a certain energy, not necessarily the same energy as the gap in the superconductor. So I don't know necessarily how to connect that idea. I started out thinking about proximity-induced topological superconductor in this central region, but that may not be the right way to think about it. So the second question is, inducing superconductivity in graphene.
Or studying the Josephson junction. Yeah. So you take graphene, plop down superconductors on either side, make a Josephson junction, and study what you find.
Right. So when he was still at Delft, I think as a grad student, Pablo Carrillo Guerrero studied Josephson junctions in graphene, and they looked beautiful, but sort of like ordinary Josephson junctions. I think that Irfan Siddiqui's group at Berkeley has made squids with graphene junctions. There's, I think, work from Jeannie Lau at Riverside on superconducting contacts in graphene. And recently, I just heard but haven't seen the work that Nadia Mason has put down superconducting islands on graphene and seen the effect on the transport through the graphene. So not from one superconducting to another, but proximity induced superconductivity in graphene. So it is an active area.
Well, so I guess what I'm trying to understand is I haven't studied either of the theory papers you mentioned, but if I just try to understand, say, your measurement from the perspective of I have some sort of direct mode, you know, whether I have one or two or six, would that make a difference in the Josephson phase current relationship, or whether you would have additional states in the middle? So this model for the understanding experiment, as far as I can tell, I'm not sure why that shouldn't also
hold through. So that's a good point. I don't have a crisp answer to that. And of course, graphene doesn't have, for the Dirac behavior there, it's not spin that's the object that's circulating, but rather pseudo-spin. But in the superconductor, of course, it's real spin that is the pairing is based on spin. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a difference based on that. There could be a difference also based on just one Dirac cone versus two times two. But it's a good question. I need to understand that better, and I welcome discussions with you or others about that. So I think it's a good question.
But actually, the one Dirac cone plays a crucial role.
I cannot argue with that. I'm just asking, what is the role? Because
it plays a role of making the superconductor topological, so that you have.
But in David's description of the junction, the analysis that was used was an SNS junction. Not a S topological superconductor S junction, right? So if there is no proof of there being an induced, proximity-induced gap in the middle region. So I'm not sure, I'm just asking questions because I'm ignorant.
The way I understand it, I think the phase gap creates a Majorana, set of Majorana modes at the edge, which is just like the Majorana modes that you'd have at the edge of a D+ IP. Somewhat similar to that. So actually, here it's the
So if you actually induce a topological superconductivity in the middle region, and that is of P+ IP nature, yes, you should have a Majorana zero mode. But I'm just trying to understand, based on the interpretation of the measurements, because the interpretation did not seem to rely on, as far as I can understand, did not seem to rely on.
Maybe a way of putting this is what Inyo is asking, what is the effect of the Majorana mode on the Josephson polling? Is there any or what is
it?
That's a good question.
And having one Dirac-Kohn versus four, should that play a role? I don't know, maybe it will.
If you have graphene, you have no Dirac edge state. You have no edge states in between the two superconducting pieces.
You have one. Dirac surface states, but not the edge.
So I think the later analysis that you showed with the Majorana modes, and that seems to substantiate. Well, so you need a pi phase shift in order to get this sort of effect.
Well, if you can explain to me better.
Yeah, but maybe outside the talk.
Yes. Yeah. Are there other questions? We've taken a long time already.
It's okay. Sorry, more questions? If not, then let's thank David for this very nice. And so this is the end of the program.